By getting 400 small organic farmers in Mexico to cooperate, team members at the Del Cabo Cooperative and Jacobs Farm were able to increase the annual incomes of those small farmers from around $3,000 to around $20,000 a year. Now, this leads us to ask, can small organic farmers prosper in Africa?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the Food Chain Radio program right here in on News Talk Radio, 925th edition today, and a very special edition it is too, because we are trying the impossible. We are trying to catch together a radio show with people in California, and people in Baja California Sur, and people in Tanzania. So, and somehow I think we have it all wired together. So stay tuned for a really fun show right here on News Talk Radio. Special thanks today to engineer Rick O'Shea.
Hello, Michael.
And producer Kelly Bayer.
Hello, Michael.
And also a big thank you to the engineers who helped us out today, pulling this together at the very last second, which is the way good engineers always do it. Folks, chances are you popped one of those organic cherry tomatoes into your mouth in the dead of winter and, without a thought, popped it and released its sweetness into your mouth and wandered off on your way. Well, today we're going to take a moment or two and consider where that organic tomato likely came from. Chances are that tomato carried a label that said Del Cabo Jacobs Farm, which means that it was produced by a cooperative of 400 or so small farmers based in San Jose del Cabo, Baja California Sur, down there on the Cape. In fact, you may well have looked down on those farms while flying into Cabo San Lucas to enjoy some of that warm winter sun. In 1985, Larry and Sandra Jacobs, farmers from Pescadero, California, decided it would be a good idea to package up some of that winter sunshine into organic cherry tomatoes and ship them north. But rather than growing the tomatoes themselves, they enlisted 10 small farmers to grow them for them. And with that agreement, the Del Cabo Cooperative was born. By working together through the Del Cabo Cooperative and with a partnership of Jacobs Farms in California, the small farmers of Baja were able to increase their annual income from $3,000 to $20,000. Today, the Del Cabo Cooperative consists of 400, give or take, small farmers in the Baja, and Jacobs Farm has grown to a company with over 60 employees in California. The Jacobs are now taking this economic food chain to Africa, which leads us to ask, can small farmers in Africa prosper? That's the question on the table today. With us from the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania, we have Larry Jacobs himself. Larry, thank you for tuning in today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Michael.
And folks who will recognize the fun sounds of Skype, so they'll pardon the little bit of echo. You're right there on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro, right?
We're right between, we're on the slopes of Mount Meru, looking with a view of Kili across the way.
Wow. Well, first of all, how in the heck did you find that place?
This was that's a long story. There was the son of the seed breeder who's been working with us for about 10 years. His son lives in New York and is connected with an investment fund who had heard about our work through him. They sent him to a conference in East Africa a few years back to give a presentation about our work, unbeknownst to us. A year later, we were asked to look at a potential program to set up something similar to what we had done in Mexico here in the northern part of Tanzania. We came here this last March. That was fell in love with the place and was asked if we would head up the program. So there you are
in Tanzania.
Pardon me?
And so there you are on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro with a whole new jihad in your hands, I guess you might call it, right?
Right. So it's an interesting program. We're working with several different NGOs who've been here a long time. They've organized different communities into commercial production groups of 7 to 15 different farmers. Each commercial production group is organized into groups of 3 to 10, which they've collated into a group called a community village. And then we're taking these community villages and bringing them into a new company as shareholders in a new company to connect them with potential export markets in the Middle East and Europe and to better penetrate large urban centers in East Africa.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a way of introducing this, I have to ask you, how is Africa different than Mexico from your perspective as a farmer?
Well, the biggest problem I'm having is trying. Nobody understands my Spanish here. They all answer me in Swahili.
That would be a problem, huh?
Baja's the southern tip of Baja is primarily new soils of granitic origin, large particle size with fast infiltration and water penetration. At the Tropic of Cancer, where we are today is it's 6 degrees south of the equator, with volcanic soils and two rainy seasons, two and one depending on what part of the country you're in. So there's more water here. The soils are incredibly rich. They have good drainage. They seem to have good nutrient levels. It's the comparison between Baja and where we are here is between the difference between a desert and a mid-altitude rainforest.
So, and thus a good reason to find it attractive, right?
I think the farmers have incredible resources in terms of the great soils. And those that have irrigation systems water year-round, and those that don't have irrigation systems have a good supply of water during the rainy season. So the natural resource base is good. It feels to me that, at least in this part of Africa, this is a very wealthy place in terms of natural resources for growing food.
Larry, one thing you had in California that I'm not sure that you have in Africa are the rich markets of, you know, they can afford to pay big premiums for those delicious Del Cabo brand cherry tomatoes.
Right, the markets here are different. The crops that the farmers that we're working with are growing are onions, carrots, potatoes, and tomatoes. We've got a base of about 3,400 growers, and then another group that's the bigger footprint of 34,000, and there's ultimately a bigger footprint of about 500,000.
Wow. So that's a lot of farmers to keep track of.
Computers are wonderful, aren't they?
Yeah, there you go. Well, I would like to introduce our other guest today, and hopefully he's on the line, John Graham, who is your man in Cabo San Lucas. John, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Michael.
Thank you. Pleased to have you aboard. So, Oklahoma farm boy to Mexico via the world.
I'm from the epicenter of the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma, in the Oklahoma Panhandle. And I've been working with Larry down here since the early 90s with the Del Cabo project. And I also spent a brief time in Africa working back in the 80s. So I pretty much, along with Larry and his wife Sandy, have dedicated a large part of my life to working with small farmers.
Well, and, you know, start off with a basic principle that most people in conventional agriculture would look at what you two are doing and the entire operation and all of the teammates, and they would go, "You guys must be crazy. Why don't you just grow 1,000 acres of cherry tomatoes in one place and call it a day?" Larry?
Well, I give you, there's a lot of reasons for not doing that. One is One is that from a practical perspective, putting things in different location gives you protection from hurricanes, from problems with weather. The microclimates in the Baja are quite pronounced. We can have a hail storm in one field, and it completely misses the area in 20 minutes south. We have a frost up against the mountains in an area called Boca La Sierra, and
Can you hold that, Larry? We're going to have to take a quick break. Michael Olson, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Larry Jacobs, John Graham, Tanzania, Mexico, California, the world. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, we have Larry Jacobs in Arusha, Tanzania. We have John Graham in San Jose del Cabo, Baja California Sur. They, the teammates of Jacobs Farm and the Del Cabo Cooperative. We have Michael Olson here in the studio on the Food Chain Radio Program, and we have you. Have you ever bit into one of those beautiful organic cherry tomatoes in the dead of winter and popped it in your mouth and tasted its sweetness go through your body? That is probably the consequence of the Del Cabo Cooperative down there in the Cape, near Cabo San Lucas, there in the sunshine. So I'd like to get a little history of that effort. Larry Jacobs, perhaps you could take us back to that day in 1985 when you and Sandra were laying on the beach in Cabo soaking up the sun and got to thinking, hey, we could do this.
So we were never one for hanging out on the beach. We spent most of our time walking around looking at little farms, and were struck by the plenty of crops. Farmers, the growers at the end of the tip of the Baja were good farmers. What they didn't have were good markets. When one farmer was harvesting tomatoes, everyone was harvesting tomatoes. And in 1985, 86, the sign on the road going into San Jose del Cabo said population 10,000. Cabo San Lucas was still more of a fishing village with a few yachts showing up. The Mexican government had it cited to become a mega tourist destination, which it has since become. But the problem the growers were having at the time was not growing good food, but everyone having the same thing at the same time in a very small marketplace. Interestingly, in the 30s, there used to be freighters or ocean-going cargo ships that would come up the Cape, stop at the bottom of the Cape, load up tomatoes, and I think they may have even loaded up cattle, and then go up to continue up the Pacific coast to Los Angeles and San Francisco, where they would unload.
Wow.
So in some ways, we renovated the tomato exporting and growing that was happening in the 30s, except we started picking same day, putting things on airplanes, and when the airplane freight became too expensive and too limited, began taking advantage of the improved roads to run things up the peninsula past San Diego to Los Angeles from where we're distributing it today.
Mm-hmm.
But the big point, I think, about Del Cabo and what John and I've done, and my wife and everybody else, has been changing the economics of for farmers in places where they didn't have economic opportunities. The farmers were making roughly $3,000 a year when we started. The change has been almost tenfold into the 30,000s. Got some families making three times that much, depending on how good a grower they are, and not on big acreages. These are like half acres to 5 acre parcels.
Wow.
And that has a big effect on all of us. It's not just the farmer making a better living, but it's a family having better health care, having better living conditions, buying books for their children going off to school, opportunities for universities. And 30 years later, or 25 years later, the young man who runs the co-op and who's the administrator, he's one of the farmer's sons. He's got a degree in accounting. Another young man who does the export documents is also a son of one of the farmers, and he became interested in international commerce because he was helping his father harvest basil and cherry tomatoes for export. And there's 100 stories like that. So the multiplier effect is there, and the impact on all of us on having better educated people contributing to producing products on our planet is good for everybody. And the added plus is everything's being done organically, so we've got something that's healthy for us to eat and environmentally grown in a good way.
Well, take us back to the original 10 farmers that you sat down and said, you know, we'd like to do this. And how did you go about organizing a co-op? I mean, when it gets right down to it, small independent farmers are generally small and very independent. And you developed some kind of an arrangement whereby they would agree to cooperate and did.
Right. So that's a great question, Michael. And we started by talking with them and asking them if they thought it was a good idea. We explained to them that if we brought all their product together in one place, we'd create economies of scales where we can make moving those products very inexpensive and really reduce the carbon footprint of moving things by putting a lot of things on one unit and moving it all together instead of trying to move a bunch of little things all independently.
Instead of 300 pickups selling points, heading up the peninsula, you have one big truck.
And one giant truck, or just 300 pickups driving, you know, driving things to La Paz or driving things to Cabo San Lucas. Just consolidating everything in one place made a lot of sense and made it a lot more efficient. And the reverse was also true. The purchase of packing supplies, seeds, making of compost, other agricultural materials that were needed to grow these crops. Instead of purchasing them in small amounts, we're now able to either make them or purchase them in large amounts, and that reduced everyone's cost. And at the end of the day, it's what you sell it for minus how much you spend growing it, and that's what's left in the farmer's pocket.
Well, John, you know, we've all heard, you know, horror stories about the Mexican federales and whatnot. How did you manage to catch an agreement with the Mexican government so that they would allow you to, you know, build this world down there?
Well, I think Baja California Sur, first of all, is the least populated Mexican state even now. So I think from the beginning, Larry and his wife Sandy established really a excellent rapport with the local agricultural department and the mayor and local politicians. So we've really had, by and large, cooperation just from all along the way. I think most of the politicians here are very proud of the fact that that this region down here is a significant organic producer. So we've really had, by and large, cooperation all the way.
Larry, it can't have all been sweetness and light. There must have been some great catastrophes.
The catastrophes were hurricanes, hailstorms, natural events like that. But I think we're really proud, and I think all the growers are proud, and the government's proud of the fact that the primary conventional use or the primary use of chemicals is on the golf courses. Almost all the farmers in the entire county are farming organically. It's probably one of the few places on the planet where almost all the food being grown is being produced organically.
So
except for the golf courses.
Except for
what's being grown on golf courses to eat.
Now, the natural resources, the Cape has water, and it has water storage facilities, correct? I mean, you're growing in the desert down there. That's where do you get your water?
You want to take that one, John?
Do you have it, John?
I'll grab it. So it's right at the Tropic of Cancer. So the Cape grabs the northern track of these tropical storms. So periodically you get this huge dump of rain from a hurricane or a big tropical storm. Because the soils are so porous and you have this mountain range that runs north and south, the clouds back up against that mountain range and dump an enormous amount of water. It all percolates down into the aquifer. The aquifer recharges very, very rapidly. And then it artesians up through this San Jose Arroyo and ends up in a freshwater lagoon at the very tip of the Baja. And that freshwater lagoon is separated by a sandbar with the Pacific Ocean. Now, that arroyo used to artesian water all the time when in the 70s and 80s before all the tourist development.
Larry, can you hold that for just a second? We've got to take a quick break. We'll come right back, talk water with Larry in Tanzania, with John in Cabo. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, can you imagine having a farm in Pescadero, California, and one in Baja, Mexico, and one in Arusha, Tanzania? Well, that's what Larry Jacobs is up to. And today we are talking with him from Arusha, Tanzania. We're also talking with John Graham, who is the coordinator of operations at Del Cabo Cooperative in San Jose Del Cabo down on the Cape. And we're talking about that little red organic cherry tomato that you ate in the dead of winter without thinking much at all about it. And you just popped it into your mouth with the rest of the salad and you bit down on it and released all of that juicy, tender sweetness. And without thinking, you swallowed it. And now we're thinking about it a little bit. We're thinking about where it came from, because the story is truly amazing of how this cooperative of 400 small farmers operating on as little as a half acre of land have been able to produce this wonderful food for us up here in the north, do it organically, and make money doing it. And in their making money, they've been able to build a community, and that's what we're talking about today. But going back to Cabo, we're talking about water, and holy smokes, how do you find enough water in the desert to grow with 400 farmers? Let's see, we're talking with Larry. John, are you there?
Yes, I briefly got cut off earlier, but I'm back here. We have, our farmers are spread out in different areas and farmer groups within the co-op. And generally, they're around a government-operated well, or many of them are. And so there is groundwater that is recharged by the rains that we get that recharge the aquifers. So it's really a very renewable resource, provided that we don't go through a long period of drought. And the other thing, that when we first came down here, the farms were growing or were utilizing water from canals, this kind of open ditch canals. And at this point in time, we pretty much converted most of, if not all of the growers to drip irrigation. So that conserves a tremendous amount of water.
And it being well water, a lot of that water is pretty good. It's almost drinking quality water, right?
Well, it is. I mean, we test and monitor to make sure that there, you know, there are no contaminants in the water. But yes, it's it, due to the fact, in part, that there's really no significant industrial contamination of water, and we're very close to the source, the mountains and the aquifers, so it's very clean, by and large.
Well, you know, we were talking about the Del Cabo cherry tomato, which, of course, is how many of us became familiar with you folks, but you grow many other things as well, correct?
Yes. We've actually, all of the culinary herbs are a big area of our total production. So everything from basil, mint, tarragon, sage, the mints, we grow those as well. We grow other vegetables like eggplants and peppers and some fruits, mainly mangoes. In the summertime, we ship mangoes from here.
Wow. Well, one of the fascinating things about your operation is that you have so much in diversity down there. But how do you find the genetics to grow in the desert like that, Larry?
How do we find the genetics? I didn't understand the question, Michael.
Well, how do you find the plant genetics, you know, suited to that hot desert growing environment?
So our winter time, November through into April, is a lot like our spring and summer in California. So the weather, the temperature works. The temperature is actually ideal for tomatoes and a lot of other crops during our wintertime. And during the summertime, it's good for mangoes, but it's too hot for tomatoes. It's so hot that the pollen won't properly set, the tomatoes won't properly set fruits. It's too hot.
Mm-hmm.
So we're taking advantage of the swing seasons by being in the Tropic of Cancer. It's where tomatoes want to grow in the dead of winter and come back up to the northern latitudes in the summertime.
So it's really well suited to serving the continental United States market, because you can grow well when, you know, people up here in the north can't then.
That's right. If it's freezing cold in New York, they're getting tomatoes from someplace. And if it's frosting in California, it's just too cold for those crops to grow. We're waiting for June and July for our summer harvest to come on. And in March it feels like July in Santa Cruz.
And I read some stories about the terrific time you have with the hurricanes down there, and you do get them down there to the extent that they wash out some of the farmers, John?
Yes, well, we're on Hurricane Alley. If you look historically, you know, over the years, we're just on the path of hurricanes that generally are in August, September, October, into early November. But it's there's no way to predict whether or not we'll have a hurricane or not. So what we try to do is we try to time our planting where it's the least risk to the growers. But there's always some risk. But one of the advantages we have, just being dispersed geographically, we have growers in many different areas. And so generally, not all of them get hit with the same. Say if a hurricane passes through, we'll have some that might be wiped out their production for the year, but others manage to avoid, you know, major damage. It's a risk we live with.
Yeah, that raises an interesting question, which is, here in the United States, we kind of have crop insurance. So if you get wiped out, you're kind of protected. Well, when we get back from this break, I'd like to ask you if you have some kind of arrangement like that for your cooperative members, wherein if disaster strikes, they can survive. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Right back with Larry Jacobs, John Graham, and you. Well, here in the California Central Coast, a strawberry farmer was recently caught spraying a prohibited pesticide onto his strawberries, and he lost his crop and lost a lot of money and probably going to go out of business. And so we wonder how exactly you can hold so many farmers to, you know, to the prescriptions, the strict prescriptions of organic farming, and not have them go astray on you. John, that must be an incredible job. How do you do it?
Well, we've from the very beginning, in fact, I originally came down here to help to organize the certification, organic certification with these farmers. And we've, in part by educating the farmers to the, you know, the organic style of pest control. But I think importantly, we try to buy the materials in bulk purchases to provide them with the farmers, so they really don't have any incentives to go out and buy products on their own. Mm-hmm. And we've had a few situations where growers have crossed the line and they've lost their membership or lost their capacity to grow. And I think all of our growers are very aware that that they don't want that to happen. So
Nothing works better than spanking them on the butt when they go astray, I guess, just like children.
But it's a very serious matter for us because we're certified as a grower group. So if one grower, you know, doesn't comply, it affects all of the other growers. So we have kind of an internal policy policing via that.
Do you have them sign written agreements?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And so you, it's like a written contract. You're going to do it this way, and you're going to conform to this way, and that's the way you're going to stay with that then.
Yeah, it's the bottom line is the NOP, the USDA NOP organic standards in the United States, and that's what everyone is required to comply with those standards.
Well, this project has really changed the nature of the community of farmers down there. There probably was not 400 farmers when you started, was there, Larry?
When we first got there, the predominant politics in the countryside outside of the urban centers was Ejido, E-J-I-D-O. That was a very forward-thinking land management policy that was established after the Mexican Revolution by a very forward-thinking gentleman by the name of Jose Vasconcelos, who was also Ministry of Education and had a lot to do with the developing the arts after the Mexican Revolution. And he realized that the landholding or the peasant population, the low-income population that had been, in a sense, serfdom to these big haciendas, didn't have the education or sophistication to hold on to their lands. So he said the Mexican government set it up so communities were the land stewards and managers, and they could use it, they could farm it, or they could do other things with it, but they couldn't buy it, or they couldn't sell it or rent it.
Oh.
So if they could manage it as a group, or they could break it up into little parcels, and each family could have their own little parcel. And once they stopped using it, it went back to the common pool. So when we first got there, that was the system that was in place. And during the Salinas administration, that changed, and the Salinas administration gave what they were called ejidos, the option to privatize their properties. And with that decision, they began doing land surveys, and we saw that all come down. And now the ejidos have the option, they can vote as a group and decide to sell off parcels of land or rent parts of the land. Now, Salinas did that because he felt like many farmers didn't have access to capital, and one limitation was not having a the asset, the land asset, to use as collateral. So that was part of the motive for that. You know, different people have different opinions. And mine is it was maybe a little short-sighted. And here was a perfect land conservation mechanism, keeping land in farmland, keeping land in open space. And that's now gone by the wayside.
So what you're doing is providing those farmers with the economic wherewithal to keep their farms in agriculture and hold on to that land in a conservation easement that's making money.
That's helped a lot. I wish it's hard to push back up against some of the rising or skyrocketing land prices as the community becomes more and more urbanized. Remember when we first started, the sign on the road coming into San Jose del Cabo was 10,000. Today, if you look up the population of the Cape area, it's around 500,000.
Wow.
So it's had enormous population growth since we first started working and living there.
And so the fight is on to keep that land in agriculture. We're going to take a quick break, a final break. And when we come back, we're going to ask Larry Jacobs from Jacobs Farms, Del Cabo brand. He in Arusha, Tanzania. And John Graham, coordinator of operations at the Del Cabo Cooperative down there in the Cape. Whether this model of pulling together 400 small farmers can work in Africa. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. By getting 400 small organic farmers in Mexico to cooperate, team members at the Del Cabo Cooperative and Jacobs Farm were able to increase the annual incomes of those small farmers from $3,000 to well over $20,000. Now the team is at work in Africa, and so today we ask them, can small organic farmers prosper in Africa? Larry Jacobs, let's start with you. What do you think?
I think the agricultural... Tanzania has a large number of small-scale farmers, and agriculture is a big part of their economic sector. And add to that that the income of many of these farmers is extremely low. And in a world that is so interconnected, there's no reason why poverty is a bane on a world that's so interconnected, and it doesn't need to exist. And one way that we can alleviate that is taking advantage of the interconnectivity we have in communication and transportation, and connect what people grow in one part of the world and connect it with another into another part of the world. So in this program here in Tanzania.
Oops. Well, John, are you there?
Okay.
I'm back.
Yes, hi.
Okay,
yeah.
He's back.
I'm back.
How
we can connect these farmers to urban centers in East Africa. There's Nairobi, Mombasa, Dar es Salaam, Kampala. These are all large urban centers. And right, the system that exists right now is traders show up at these guys' farms. The farmers don't have any idea what the prices are in these urban centers, and they're really at the mercy of the traders and the brokers who come roadside asking to buy these guys' crops.
You know, Larry, it seems like agriculture has always been, farmers have always been in a position where they grow a crop and then they take it to market and say, what will you give me? And it seems like you and John and your fellow teammates at Del Cabo Cooperative, Jacobs Farm, have figured out a way of growing crops and then going to the market and saying, this is what you should pay me.
We're going to the market and looking at what the market will do, and then creating relationships in the marketplace directly with supermarket chains and large distributors wherever we're going with it, and starting with what the market needs, instead of rolling the dice. A lot of farmers do is they get excited about a crop, they plant the crop, they don't really have a sense of how much to plant and what the demand is. So, and if they have a good year, they plant more. And that's just a formula for losing money, because it costs money to grow a crop. But I firmly believe that if you're a farmer and you have land and water and you're skilled, you're really in control of the situation. But before you plant, know your market, have some prospective sales, and plant to that market instead of gambling and planting every inch of your, you know, every square foot that you have and hoping you're going to sell it.
Can you build a brand for those Tanzania farmers as you have built a brand for those Mexican farmers? The Del Cabo brand is a precious brand. I mean, people trust that when they see that label, they think, that's a clean, organic tomato. I can pop that in my mouth and enjoy it. Can you build that same kind of brand in Africa?
We hope to be able to build a brand like that in Africa. So we've got the difference between what we did in Mexico and what we're doing, we're working on here in Africa, is we have a lot of support for the effort. We're working with several NGOs that have been here on the ground for a long time, for 30 years. And they're providing some capital to organize these farmer-owned businesses. What we did in Kabul, we did out of our back pockets with whatever pocket change we were able to scrape off or find in the bottom of the truck. So the growth was limited. The number of farmers we were able to reach in the beginning was limited. And the success was based on growing something that really tasted good, that people could trust and believe in. Something that tastes good is a big selling point.
Amen.
And then the icing on the cake is that it's organically grown, and the money's going to
back to the community. Larry Jacobs from Tanzania, John Graham from Mexico. Thank you both for joining us today. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. It's the Del Cabo brand. Taste it.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.